Our second matter today is 2022-0382 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Michael Swayze Jr. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Vellucci. Good morning.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Vince Vellucci with the Medina County Prosecutor's Office for the appellant, the State of Ohio. I'll start with our first proposition of law having to do with the motion to dismiss the indictment. Your Honors, we all know that there's no such thing as summary judgment in a criminal case. But this court has held that Criminal Rule 12 allows a court to consider evidence beyond the face of the indictment when ruling on a motion to dismiss an indictment if the matter is capable of determination without trial of the general issue. That has been the standard in the Brady case and the Palmer case, which is important, obviously, to the ruling below here. The State of Ohio submits that standard has become unworkable and has essentially led to summary judgment prior to trial. This court, we suggest, should reaffirm the principle that unless it can be determined from the face of an indictment that it is legally defective, then the time to test the sufficiency of the state's case.
Why wouldn't we just follow the rule? I mean, if you seem to concede that the rule says what it says, which is if it can be determined without determination of the general matter, then it can be determined on a motion. I mean, the rule should be controlling, shouldn't it?
Well, it says what it says, but it's not clear, Your Honor.
What's not clear about it?
What's not clear is what the general issue for trial is in any given case.
Well, isn't the general issue for trial in a criminal case whether they're innocent or guilty, whether they committed the crime?
And certainly Palmer takes a stab at it and says it's just simply whether the accused violated the law as set forth in the indictment, which is sort of the issue in every criminal case. The problem is here, once you start letting in all of this evidence pre-trial, that's a slippery slope. You're allowing defendants to essentially try cases without
this case didn't require
trial.
This case didn't require a lot of additional evidence.
This case it required and I would say it's not appropriate. It's not clear in every case. I think what evidence is appropriate and what isn't.
Should this case have been dismissed at a Rule 29?
Well, that would depend on the ruling on whether the new child support law issued in 2019, passed in 2019, is retroactive or not. And this court has not opined on that issue, and no court in this case has opined on that issue yet. There was not a clear matter of law here to rule on.
Is our Rule 12 unconstitutional?
I think it may be, Your Honor.
Why?
Well, because what you're doing here, essentially, the factual information in this case, if you look at it, absolutely goes to the general issue in the case as to whether the defendant is guilty or not of the underlying offense. The only way to know that one of these counts was arrearage only in this case is to look at that outside evidence, that domestic relations document from 2014 that says it was terminated on this date, and that's when it became arrearage only. That's the only way to know that.
Aren't the on its face, birth dates of the children in the indictment?
Well, the birth date doesn't tell you when the support was at the date the support order was actually terminated. That's the relevant date, not the birth date. And you have to know that in order to know when exactly this became arrearage only. It's not just when the child turns 18. It's when the child graduates from high school. So that's the relevant date, and that can only be known with outside evidence in this case. So the court just looking at the indictment says, This is a valid indictment on its face. It's saying, it's in the language of the applicable statute. It says, for these three 104-week periods, 26 out of them, it was not, the child support was not paid. There's no way for the trial court to know that any of those are arrearage only without outside evidence being brought in.
Sorry, counsel, I want to go back to the constitutionality issue. Can you point me to a provision in the state constitution by number or wording that this, our Rule 12 violates?
Well, I think, I don't have one particularly offhand, but I think it should be looked at. The rule, I think, conflicts with Criminal Rule 29 and with traditionally what we understand as the sufficiency of the evidence and how that should be set forth. In the Palmer case, I think it's not. I think it's different.
Even if there's an error, why wouldn't it be harmless if it was subject to, if it had been subject to a Rule 29 motion?
Well, it would have been subject to a Rule 29 motion, but so.
I mean, if it doesn't state a claim, it doesn't. If it's not violative of the law, what difference does it make? When it gets dismissed.
I think it's a big difference for the defendant not having to risk a trial and being able to just file a motion to dismiss and then.
So it's a big difference because it would give the state additional leverage to be able to try them for something that's not a crime? That doesn't seem right.
Well, we disagree. I mean, with that
I'm asking you to explain. I mean, you have to show both that there's an error and that it was prejudicial to the state, right? So if it would have been subject to a Rule 29 motion anyway, why is it prejudicial if the judge got rid of it before he or she should have?
Well, so we believe that this law is retroactive, so it does. So this defendant is factually guilty.
Okay, but that's not one of the assignments of error, right?
Right. So the indictment here, Your Honor, was valid on its face. The indictment in Palmer was not. That's the difference.
I'm sorry, that doesn't really answer the question, right? My question is, if it was subject to a Rule 29 motion, because under these facts you could not convict him of this crime, which I think is, we all have to agree is true, unless the statute's retroactive, then what difference does it make? And so how can you show prejudice?
I think once you start allowing defendants to try their cases pre-trial, that is prejudicial to the state of Ohio to be able to bring in evidence.
The state knows means it's outcome determinative.
I think it allows them to circumvent the trial process and the Rule 29 process.
Okay, so it's error. But again, you have to show error, and then you have to show that it's prejudicial, so to get something reversed on appeal.
And I think it is prejudicial to the state of Ohio, both from a procedural standpoint and substantive, Your Honor. In this case, we believe that the statute is retroactive, although no court has specifically said that yet. That the time to decide that would have been at trial in this case, because that's when the outside evidence about what's arrearage only and what isn't would properly be allowed to be admitted.
So can we move on to Prop 2?
Yes, absolutely.
But is it really your contention that the law, are we wrong that the law says if you plead guilty, you can still attack that plea, you know, the constitutionality? The statute? Didn't we say that in 1979 in State v. Wilson? That's been the law since then?
Well, I think The Ninth District's ruling on that was based on a very, very confusing sentence from the Fitzpatrick case about 20, 25 years ago. But Fitzpatrick also held that a defendant who knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily enters a guilty plea with the assistance of counsel cannot thereafter raise independent claims relating to the deprivation of constitutional rights that occurred prior to the entry of the guilty plea. And that's exactly what we have here, Your Honors.
But that's not what State v. Wilson says, correct?
Well, so in this case, what happened, the Ninth District held that Swayze was not barred from appealing the motion to dismiss issue here, whether it's retroactive and so forth. The court essentially reasoned that even if Swayze is factually guilty, his argument that application of the statute to his case, his argument is that application of the statute to his case is a constitutional violation. I would say, first of all, that's flawed logic, but it's also never what Swayze has argued in this case, and the Ninth District has it backwards in that regard. Swayze's argument has always been that on the arrearage-only count, he's factually not guilty because the amended child support statute is not retroactive. That's his argument. That's an issue of statutory interpretation, Your Honors, not a constitutional issue. It only becomes a constitutional issue if the court first declares the amended statute to be retroactive. Neither court in this case has done that, and this court has not opined on the issue, as I mentioned. Essentially, what that very confusing sentence in Fitzpatrick says is that if a defendant can be factually guilty in a case, but the underlying statute is unconstitutional, a guilty plea doesn't waive the issue for appeal. But that's the opposite of what we have in this case, I would submit, Your Honors. Here, if the statute was found to be retroactive, and then it was found to be an unconstitutional ex post facto law, or if it was just found not to be retroactive, it's only a proactive law, that decides the general issue in the case, and Swayze would be factually not guilty on the arrearage-only counts. By him pleading guilty, he's saying, essentially, I believe this statute is retroactive, that it applies to me, and I am factually guilty of this. That's why when he enters a guilty plea, he waives that issue for appeal. It's a classic type of issue that should be waived.
Even if he's wrong about the constitutionality of it?
I mean, like I said, that issue has not been decided by this court yet. It's not been decided by the Ninth. It's not been decided by the trial court. That could be decided later, but at the time, he was guilty. And he pled guilty. So to then, it really undermines the effect of a guilty plea, and it makes you wonder what's the difference between a guilty plea and a no contest plea. If you can still appeal something like this after having pled guilty in a case.
But don't we want to get the law right?
We do, but once somebody pleads guilty, this isn't the case to do it in, because he's waived that issue. He stood up before the court and said, "I'm guilty of this." So he's conceded this statute is not this statute is constitutional. It applies to me. It's not. It's retroactive. That's what he's saying when he pleads guilty. Because if it's if it's proactive, if it's prospective, then he's not factually guilty.
So you're saying that when the court denied his motion on the constitutional basis, he should have pled no contest instead of guilty, correct?
If he wanted to still contest that issue on appeal, the proper thing to do would have been to plead no contest, correct? That's supposed to be the way to preserve pretrial defects in the case. I think the Ninth District has upset that here with this ruling, which is based on some very confusing language that from Fitzpatrick that, frankly, I read you the main holding of Fitzpatrick earlier. I think that very confusing line is dicta at best. So I think it needs to be clarified that something like this, a guilty plea does waive that pretrial motion to dismiss. And even if you don't find that general proposition to be true, in this particular case, just on the facts, this is an issue of statutory interpretation, whether it's retroactive or not. That is the issue. It's not a constitutional issue, even if you believe that is the standard or should be the standard, because the constitutional ex post facto part does not come into play unless it's first found to be retroactive, and nobody's found that yet with this law, Your Honors. So I would respectfully ask that the Ninth District be reversed.
If it's retroactive, then you have to get to the constitutional issue. So the only way the state can win is if it's both retroactive and constitutional. So there is a constitutional issue here.
But Your Honor, nobody has yet said that it is retroactive yet. So it never got to that point
in this
case. Right,
but if it's not retroactive, then you can't charge him under it.
That's true. That's been our position from the beginning. That this is retroactive, and that's why we've been charging these arrearage only cases. But that has not been decided yet, and that frankly is not at issue in this case. But I think it will be decided eventually. But it just hasn't been decided yet. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Briggs. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Justice Kennedy. Associate Justices, may it please the court. My name is Addison Spriggs on behalf of Mr. Michael Swayze. A motion to dismiss is the proper vehicle for a trial court to resolve the legality of and the constitutionality of an indictment and its underlying statute. This is imperative so that courts do not proceed to a full trial before determining the constitutionality of the charges. The appellate court found that a motion to dismiss...
Is there a limit to how much outside information a court can look at in a motion to dismiss? I mean, do you envision that courts could have many hearings? I mean, the material is pretty limited, but you seem to be advocating for a pretty broad rule. So explain how that rule would work.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not arguing for a broad interpretation. Criminal 12F does say that the court can look at other documents and exhibits outside the indictment itself. But the limitation would be whether or not it determines the general rule or the general issue of the case. The general issue in this case is, did Mr. Swayze fail to make support payments that he was obligated by a court order to make? That's the general issue. What he challenged was whether or not the statute applied to him. So in this case, he wasn't reaching the general issue, and that's the limitation on what the court could consider at that motion to dismiss stage.
But if, I guess under your view, if it doesn't go to the general issue in the case, this one's pretty straightforward, but in another case, then the court could consider multiple affidavits, evidence certified by affidavits. I mean, we could have kind of a mini trial before trial, if it need be, to decide something.
No, Your Honor. If the evidence is going to the elements of the offense,
under my hypothesis, it's not going to the elements of the offense. It's something like this, but it's more complicated to prove.
I respectfully, Your Honor, that would be a different case. I think it is cabined. I don't think it's an open universe of the court.
What's it cabined by?
Whether or not it goes to the general issue.
I understand it's cabin to that, but beyond that, I mean, you can imagine all kinds of things that may go to something beyond factual guilt that might take a lot of proof. So is there any cabining to that?
The cabining is whether or not the statute itself is constitutional. So you're only, in this case, and you know, in other cases, you would only be challenging the legality of the statute itself. You're not getting to
But you're also not just whether the statute is constitutional, but also whether his conduct falls within the statute, right?
No, that is the, if the conduct falls within the statute, that's where it would get to the trial.
You're here, for example, you have to show when the arrearages were, so that's, there's a timing element, right? It's not just saying the statute's unconstitutionally retroactive. You had to go back and look at what the timing was.
I understand that in this case there was the termination of child support order, but even on the face of the indictment, you had the birth date of the child, which was in the middle of count one. Even when you get to count three, so counts two and three are beyond the 19th birthday of the minor in the case. And this indictment extends beyond her 21st birthday.
Counsel, so, isn't the cabining that we're talking about, if you're taking information outside the indictment, if those facts aren't subject to dispute, like in this case? There's no dispute that he was...
Correct, Your Honor. There is no dispute that he was not under a current support payment as of June 8th, 2014, which is in the middle of count one. So counts two and three are beyond that. It's the state has never contested the validity of the termination of support order. And again, this, it's not going to the general issue. It's going to whether or not he could, it's going to the legality of the prosecution itself and whether or not he can be hailed into court on charges that he cannot be constitutionally charged of. And that's why it's proper for a court to determine that before you have a full trial with the expenditure of necessary resources. As I said, Criminal Rule 12F answers the question posed in Proposition of Law 1. And this court has already settled that in both the Palmer and the Brady cases. So it doesn't need to look beyond its case law. To find in favor of the state, it would have to overrule both Palmer and Brady, and that would be in direct contravention of Criminal Rule 12F. As I said, Mr. Swayze's motion didn't get to the general issue, and the trial court erred when it said it couldn't reach the merits.
So what about count one?
So you say count two, count three should be out because you had the date of birth, and even if the child could have had an order of support to the age of 19, counts two and three are beyond that, so they're gone. What about count one?
Count one is a closer issue, and I would concede that that may take more of a factual determination. But the fact of the matter is that if you remove counts two and three during a plea negotiation, it changes the situation.
So going back to Justice DeWine then, so the trial court errs in denying the strike of counts two and three. So you go forward. Your choice then is to plead and or go to trial. And the decision was to plead to all counts.
Correct.
So where does that take you after you plead? Standing here saying that maybe one could not have been dismissed.
It changes the analysis, or it changes the plea negotiation situation, and it also changes the decision whether or not to go to trial. There's a difference between being exposed to three felony counts with a maximum of 36 months on each count, as opposed to one count with a maximum term of 36 months. So you're looking at 9 years versus three. I think that changes the plea negotiation process and the decision of whether or not to proceed to trial. But we also get then to the guilty plea aspect. And as Justice Fisher indicated, I provided supplemental authority in State v. Wilson that says exactly the same thing as Fitzpatrick, which says the exact same thing as Mena, that there are two exceptions to a guilty plea waiving defects in prior stages. And those two exceptions are constitutional violations and jurisdictional questions. Here, the state has conceded at all stages that he's argued about the constitutionality of the statute as applied to him. And Wilson says there's a difference between constitutional violations which go to factual guilt and constitutional violations which pertain to the validity of the statute itself. When those constitutional violations go to the ability of the state to prosecute and to hail a defendant into court, That may be raised on appeal from a guilty plea.
So what's the purpose? Our rules make this distinction, allowing people to plead no contest. What's the purpose of a no contest plea if you can raise this kind of stuff anyway?
The no contest plea preserves more issues. Take, for example, a Fourth Amendment issue. That would go to factual guilt. Here, it's about the validity of the statute. And so that's the difference as to constitutional, the validity of the constitution of the statute itself, as opposed to issues of factual guilt that would be properly preserved with a no contest plea. If there are no further questions, Mr. Swayze asks that this court either dismiss this case as improvidently allowed because it seeks to challenge settled law, or affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals and remand to the trial court for a decision on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll receive a copy of a decision in the mail. Marshall, would you call a recess?
All rise.